Welcome. Thanks for coming out this evening. I am Andrea Jung, and I'm going to be our moderator tonight with our two wonderful and distinguished guests. They really are experts on how women can use their economic success to really drive change and to achieve success. Their book, Fast Forward, How Women Can Achieve Power and Purpose, has just been launched to resounding success, and I think there are many aspects about this book that make it quite different. There are many, many books out there, but you know, I think that Milan and Kim are going to talk about what it is that really drove them. So let me just start with that and say, you know, what made the two of you write this book? What was it about your experiences, and how did it bridge back to your experience as the first global ambassador for women's issues and your current role at Georgetown? What was the experience set over the last years, just kind of going through country after country, that made you feel like you needed to share this story?
Well, there's a lot happening around the world, and there's a lot happening in the women's space, particularly in terms of women's increasing advancement in positions of responsibility and power. Women are on the front lines of change all over the world, some of them pushed back, some of them demonstrating enormous courage, great risk, trying to make a difference. And at the same time, we sit on a plethora of data, research, a strong evidence-based case today that when you invest in women and girls, you invest in economic growth, you create jobs, you enhance inclusive prosperity, you promote social progress. Women spend their income differently. 90% and upwards is plowed into the family, into the community. It raises the standard of living. Women entrepreneurs are accelerants for growth. They are significant drivers of growth. And yet, despite this and so much more, neither companies nor governments nor other organizations that are trying to either grow economies or advance social progress often tap the potential of women. And at the same time, we are in a unique position to connect as never before. I mean, you know that better than anybody. We sit here in the technological capital of the world. It is easier to connect today than it ever was. So our strong thesis is that this moment is an historic moment. It is a unique moment with this confluence of factors, more and more women advancing, a strong evidence base, the ability to connect easily, much more easily than ever before, that enables us to advance progress for women and girls unlike any time in history. In other words, to fast forward. And in the process, we lay out in the book ways in which to do that and the kind of difference it makes.
Kim,
yeah,
two have such different backgrounds.
Yeah.
Why this book for you?
Well, I disagree with everything Milan says, of course, that we are at this unique moment in history. I mean, I come from the private sector. Milan comes from the public sector. And what we both saw in our work was that women could be this incredible force for good, really agents of change around the world. And the reason why this moment might be a little different than any moment in history is because, really, for three reasons. We know that investing in women drives economies and social progress. We know it today that diversity matters and it drives the bottom line. We know that people who are visionary people have a China strategy, they have an India strategy, but today you also need a global women's strategy if you want to succeed anywhere in the world. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that we have women in historical levels of leadership. Yes, we're still stuck at 16%. There is a glass ceiling, or as some people say, a thick layer of men. But we also know that we're everywhere else. Women are storming the ranks from the public sector to the private sector, across countries, across socioeconomic strata. Women are connecting like never before. And as Milan just pointed out, we are in the middle of a technology revolution, a revolution that has the ability to change the way we work and live. And so what we found is that as women are ascending to power, which they are all over the world in different capacities, they're increasingly using their power for purpose. And they're in the process redefining what power looks like and redefining what success means.
You know, you both talk about the fact that the data is in. We could talk about fast forwarding, but it's almost like we need to go perhaps on warp speed because the data is in, but some of the data is just, you know, it's depressing. 78 cents on a dollar when it's been stuck at 77 cents a woman is making to a dollar man, and so the one penny difference after such a long time. So talk a little bit about sort of what the optimistic data shows, and then where it's not moving, I mean, why isn't it moving, and what do we think we can do, and how is the toolkit going to help us break through?
Well, this was one of my frustrations in government, as well as working with many companies that are on the cutting edge, and we're increasingly working in a collaborative spirit with government and public-private partnerships. But one often felt that there just wasn't this recognition of what a difference women can make if they're invested in. And it was so manifested. I had experiences where, you know, I often felt that people would look at me as the ambassador for women and say, oh, here she comes again. We know what she's going to say. And this perception that these are really marginal issues. They're not that important. They're nice issues. Nobody's going to complain about them. But let's just keep them to the side. And if we can have some extra resources, whether they're public or private, we'll put them there. But the reality is, if you really focus on any number of data points today, the most recent one came out just a couple weeks ago from the McKinsey Institute that said that we could drive the economic growth by depending in how it was done, either at current levels, if you equalize the position of men and women in their economic participation, or actually made gender equality a reality, you could drive growth in the world between $12 trillion and $28 trillion. This is a massive engine for change. The World Economic Forum, nobody will ever accuse it of being a women's organization. You know, these are the top people in the economies of the world. They put out an annual gender gap report. Now, why do they do a gender gap report? Because what they have found as they analyze the data from countries, that in those countries where men and women are more equal, and in no place are they equal, on four metrics, access to health, education, economic participation, and political participation, those countries are far more prosperous and they are far more economically competitive. Now, personally, I think this is a no-brainer. We've got all the data now that shows us this. But the reality is, if you cut off the talent of half the population of the world, you're not going to have the same impact. And that's one of the reasons we're at the point, because so much of this is building and growing, and there are increasing leaders, men and women, who are stepping up to the plate, who are using it, who are having impact, and they are in the ranks of those agents for change globally.
Let's talk about that, because, you know, there's a lot of discussion that, you know, women's power and influence is sort of, we're talking to ourselves, women are talking to other women, but, you know, the role of men in the advocacy of gender equality, because it's everybody's issue. How do you view that today versus where it was, you know, years ago? You've had a front seat both here domestically as well as in, you know, multiple countries from the developing and the developed world. What is the role and the best examples that we're seeing of men taking a very equal and powerful advocacy in getting women to the top, whether it's politics or whether, you know, it's business or NGOs?
It's absolutely essential, Andrea. And the book is not an anti-male book. It is a book with many male champions and partners in this process, ranging from people like the CEO of Coca-Cola, who says and recognizes that today women are the most dynamic force in economic growth worldwide. It's people like Muhammad Yunus, the Nobelist, who started to loan equally to men and women tiny amounts of credit to the poorest of the poor globally. And what he found was women paid their loans back. Today, they're lending 90% to 10%. Those loans are dramatically transforming the lives of people in micro businesses. SMEs are important. Building entrepreneurship is important at the small and medium level because, as the World Bank calls it, that's the missing middle. That's what drives economies. And we really need to focus on women as entrepreneurs because they've got such an ability when they have the capacity and access to credit, access to markets, training and mentoring. Once that's unleashed, tremendous growth can occur. So there's just so many ways that impact can be registered today. And these male champions are in companies, they're in the nonprofit sector, they are increasingly in government.
I just want to pick up on the point about women entrepreneurs and the Grameen model in particular, because we know that women entrepreneurs drive growth around the world, and I think Professor Muhammad Yunus proved that with Grameen. But you, Andrea, taking Grameen America with Muhammad Yunus to the U.S. to show that financial inclusion in the U.S. could drive economic growth and create jobs, I think is a real revelation. So we're at this point where we know women's entrepreneurship grows economies. In fact, in this country alone, women entrepreneurs are growing at 1.5 times the national average. And think about this. If women entrepreneurs were a country, their GDP would rank fifth in the world, just under Germany. That's how powerful women entrepreneurs are in this country. So you know, we have this incredible moment which we need to seize. And I think the male champions that you mentioned, that is a shift. We see in the halls of power that men are championing women because they know that when women progress, economies progress. And so it's not a women's issue, really. It's a human issue. And I think everyone's starting to recognize that.
You know, if I can just tell you a story out of my own experience in the State Department, one of my colleagues came to me because the United States belongs to this organizational platform called APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Council. It includes the United States. It is among some of the most powerful economies and among some of the less powerful economies, 21 economies. And he said, you know, I think you should send somebody to participate in this from the staff. And I said, well, to what point? Because I had looked at the agenda, there was no focus on the economic role of women in the economies. And I said, isn't there anything we can do about this? And he sort of shrugged and said, well, you know, at that time, this is a rotating baton, if you will, to head up APEC every year. So it rotates among the 21 economies, and at that time, it was Japan. He said, you can come to Japan and you can talk to the my counterparts. They were mostly all male ambassadors representing their economies in APEC. And what was really hitting me like a stone against my head was a figure that a data point from the United Nations that said that upwards of $90 billion is lost annually in GDP in the Asia-Pacific region because the potential of women is not tapped. And I thought, here we are bringing together the top business barons, the top leaders in these economies, ministers of the economy, presidents and prime ministers, and there's no focus whatsoever on women. So I made my pitch, and when I finished speaking, one of the ambassadors came up to me immediately, and he said, with some positive surprise, you talked about growth. And I thought, what did he expect me to talk about? Maybe the Feminist Manifesto was going to be proclaimed or something. But as a result, and the work, again, of another woman who was in a position of power, she worked for Goldman Sachs in Tokyo. She was an Asian American. She was a top economic thinker. She had done a study several years ago called Womenomics. And as she said, nobody paid attention to the study. But she had really analyzed what had to happen to the Japanese economy for it to get through its stagflation to begin to grow in ways it wasn't growing. And as a result of this confluence of APEC, her work, government leaders listening. The Prime Minister of Japan today has women's economic participation as one of the key rungs of his economic reform program. And APEC now has a significant agenda focused on women and the economy. And the first ever summit, a year after that Japan meeting, was held here in San Francisco when the United States led it. And we passed the San Francisco Declaration, which all the leaders signed on to focus on women's entrepreneurship, to begin to close the gap in those critical elements that we need to grow entrepreneurship. And that is a focus to this day as one of the prongs of what APEC has been championing. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Using our positions where we find ourselves, whether at the top, the middle, at the base, to really create the kind of change that lifts up everybody, not just women, but women and men and boys and girls.
So just to pick up on what you were talking about, you talked a little bit about APEC and Asia, but let's come back here, home, and maybe, you know.
Well, this affected us too, because we were a member, and we need to do a lot more to champion women's entrepreneurship in this country.
Yeah, so I just wanted to sort of talk as it relates to, from a policy point of view, from a corporate point of view, how much, you know, how much more advanced or not are we in the areas that you see? You know, I've heard numbers of the percent of women in Congress. I mean, you know, you would think we would be that much further ahead domestically as the most forward nation in the world. And what, you know, what's it going to take? But let's just talk a little bit about business, Kim, and how you're viewing women progressing in business at all levels, because it's just as much about the middle as it is at the top. And then maybe, Milan, we can talk about, you know, from your life in Washington, how you view that too.
I mean, this is an optimistic book, because I think Milan and I both believe that, yes, we are stuck, as we said earlier, we are stuck on the very top in the leadership levels, but we're so close right now, and we are everywhere else.
Glass half full.
The glass is very much full, and in fact, you know, women are really making many of the decisions in corporate America today. It may not be at the CEO level, but let's face it, most decisions don't get made at the CEO level, right? I always think that the CEOs sometimes have the least power in a company because they're completely dependent on everybody else. So we are in the kitchen cabinet. We are right there making the day-to-day trade-offs. And women are storming the ranks of every organization, not just corporate America. So that's, I think, a really important thing that we have to keep in mind, because we are going to break through. We will break through. So it's just that, you know, it took 70 years for women to get the right to vote in this country. But we think this is a particularly unique moment where we could fast forward and leapfrog. And I think we will, because of the three things that we laid out earlier. But I think it's also important for each of us to understand that we're not going to break through if it's a top-down strategy. It's not going to happen if we're waiting for leaders at the top to move us all forward. That they have their role to play. But I honestly believe that in today's world, it's for each of us. We are less in a hierarchical, and we are more in a horizontal environment than we've ever been before, because we have access to information. We have access to skills, unprecedented amount of skills that women and men have today. And we actually have a lot of power. And I think it's really important for each of us to understand our power. And that's what the toolkit is about. How do you understand your own power? How do you find your own purpose? And we're going to hopefully talk about purpose, because I think that's a really equally important part of this book, which is, how does each individual find their purpose? Because just like the data is in on the economy, the data is also in that if purpose is a part of your work and your life, you find much more greater life satisfaction. And so one of the things that is holding us back, though, in this country is childcare. And, you know, we talk about tactical fixes for childcare, but Milan and I both believe that it's a design flaw. That why would you ever, in today's day and age, design a school day that's 9 to 3 and a work day that's 9 to 7? You would just never do it, you know? So as women are ascending to these positions, though, they are opening up the conversation for redesigning what success looks like. How do we want to work and live? Why do we pit work against life? We talk about work-life balance. It doesn't even make any sense. So we need to rethink the way what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think men want that too. I think Milan will speak to you probably at some point. But in the book, we talk about the fact that, you know, 60% of millennials want purpose and impact and well-being in their work, not men versus women, 60% of millennials. So I think this isn't a women's issue. Everybody wants that, men and women. So I think, though, that women ascending to positions of power are creating the opportunity to open up these conversations. And look, we are at a reset moment. Technology is allowing us to do things differently. I hailed a cab for the first 40 years of my life. Now I take Lyft or Uber or you name your, you know, thing of choice, because we can, right? We can redesign things. Technology can have us do what we've always done faster, or we can do things differently. And I think we're at this moment where we can do things differently.
I want to go back to this issue of challenges in our own country, and childcare is surely one of them. And the reason we've got this mismatch in many ways is because the structures were put in place when women weren't working so much outside the home in the formal economy. The whole family, in fact, was initially working together. And you had this transition taking place, but we've not really kept up with the transition. So today you find the majority of women with a child under one working outside the home, working through a hodgepodge of childcare ways and means to provide both affordable care and ensure that the child is safe and stimulated. And clearly we can do better. We can be both good parents and good employees. And this truly is not an issue that should be just something that women are discussing, because it affects the children, it affects families, it affects our country. It's a serious issue. Back when I was working in the Clinton White House, and Ann Bartley is here, and she was a colleague of mine, we held the first ever childcare conference that the First Lady at the time, Hillary Clinton, put together. And she said to me, she said, you know, get Bob Rubin in, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, to open this conference. And when I said to Bob, we need you to do this, he looked at me like, what do I know about childcare? But the reality was, it was a very strong message to send, because the Secretary of the Treasury has as much of an important role to play as the Secretary of Health and Human Resources in this space. And we've got to shift the way we talk about these issues. Same thing about equal pay for equal work. There was a time when this was only championed by men, by women, until men began to calculate too. That's 21 cents less on the dollar in my family every single day that that wage is earned. And that doesn't help. And think of single breadwinners today and what losing that amount of money represents. Or the fact that we're the only industrialized country in the world without paid maternity leave or family leave. These are critical issues. And I think for too long, they've not been somehow viewed as very serious policy issues. They've been shunted to the side. And that's one of the calls today, that we really understand that we've got many, many reasons to critically address these issues. And we've got abilities like we've never had before to do so. And we really need to focus on them.
So does a woman in a White House make a difference?
Well, I think...
Will she?
I think that what a woman does... And first of all, it's not that women are better than men or men better than women in the public sphere. But think about this. What happens in public policy? The policies that are made affect every one of us, whether we're a man or a woman. Most of the policies are being made with half the population, without half the population participating. We have in our Congress, for example, 17% of women in the Congress. Now, they're not a monolithic force. They look at things differently. But even in the United States, where we have made progress on some of these social issues or economic issues, it's because Republican women have crossed the aisle with Democratic women. They've joined forces and brought along their male colleagues. That happened on Title IX. Look at all the women who are bringing home medals to the United States today because Title IX was passed. Public resources were released on public campuses so that girls could have equal access in athletics. The domestic violence law is one of the strongest laws in the country. It's a model for the world of how we need to address domestic violence in terms of prevention, awareness programs, shelters, and, of course, prosecution. Breast cancer issues, other health issues, these happened because women crossed the aisle. And I think we know from other countries. India, for example, has... At the very local level, the panchayats, the village level, it's been called The Silent Revolution in Democracy, because there are over 1 million women now in those positions. They started as quota positions. There is still a quota, but they are running in far more positions that are not quota positions and being elected. Why? And the data shows this. They are investing in sanitation. They're investing in education. They're investing in the things that make village life much better than it was. They're spending public resources differently. So for me, it's not better or less better, if that's a figure. It's the fact that there are talents, perspectives, and experiences that women possess that should be part of the decision-making process to provide us with a much richer outcome in the kinds of policies we want to develop.
Kim, I just want to go back deeper to the discussion about purpose, because a big part of the book really is it instigates a powerful belief that, you know, there can be purpose in life, obviously, not just purpose in work, and that is a very important holistic piece of it. But talk about, define purpose the way the two of you really are driving at it in the book, and then just some examples, I mean, a moment in your life where you understood that it was about purpose, not just the work, that was going to drive your future.
Well, I think for me that's the most important part of this book on a personal level, because I've always been very interested in advancing women and girls. That's sort of in my blood. I was born in the women's movement. I'm a big believer that advancing women will advance the world. And so coming into the book, I knew that was the thesis, and I knew that the data was in, and that's why Melinda and I wanted to write it, because we wanted to make the case and let everybody else make the case. But what was really interesting for me coming out of the book was that the data is also in on purpose, and that, you know, I was just recently speaking at an event at the New York Academy of Science that was co-hosted by the Knorr Foundation with two professors of happiness. There's actually professors of happiness, right? It's the job I want in my next life. And so... You know, one of them was a historian. He wrote the book on literally the history of happiness. And the other one was a social scientist. And really, it's empirical. When you find purpose, and by purpose, you know, Melinda and I have found our purpose in advancing women and girls. But the idea of purpose is having a larger arc of meaning in your life. So happiness, the definition that I think about is need reduction. So you're hungry, you eat, you're happy. You want to buy a pair of shoes, you buy them, you're happy for a couple of days, right? But, you know, those are not things that last. Meaning, however, is something that lasts, and it sort of ties your past, present, and future into something bigger. And when you find that, there's a great quote by Dr. Elahi in the book that talks about when you find your larger purpose, you create an arc for your life where the day-to-day ups and downs become these little dusty storms on the road of your larger journey. And I think that's a really brilliant way of thinking about things. And all the science supports it. You know, we think that where we live, who we're married to, and how much money we make is really what defines happiness. And in fact, it's really not. It's getting out of yourself. And what Melinda and I really share and how we connected over this whole topic is that we very much believe that the service of others, if you can use your power, your ability to have impact, your ability to have agency over your life for something greater than yourself, it creates a virtuous, you think you're doing it for other people, but ultimately you're doing it for yourself. And so for me, the big turning point in my life was, you know, as I said, I was always interested in these issues, but when that Dr. Elahi came back from Cambodia, he had operated on a 6-week-old baby who had been doused with acid. She was breastfeeding with her mother. There was a sort of marital dispute. A woman came to her house and said, you know, give me a dollar and I'll go, I want to move into your house. And she said, no, you're not moving in. And she said, I'll give you some money to go away. And the woman took the money, went to the market, bought acid, came home, and threw it on the mother and baby while they were breastfeeding. And the baby was blinded in both eyes, and the mother was burned on 30% of her body. And when I saw that video, I was at the time working at Avon, Andrew Jung was our CEO, and I realized, listen, I'm a lawyer, I work at the company for women, and there was no penalty. They just said, throw the baby out, we'll make another. Someone had been said, heard to have said that. And so when I thought there was no penalty for this, I thought, really, there's something very wrong in the world, and I can do more than I'm doing. And so for me, that was the moment where, you know, I recognized that each person can make a difference. And through a whole journey that you'll read about in the book, we ended up starting a Center for Women in Justice at Cornell, which is my alma mater, and and Avon supported it, and we started bringing together women judges from around the world, and Justice O'Connor even stepped in. And I tell you, one of the best days of my life was when my phone rang in my office, and I picked it up, and I heard this voice that said, "Is this Kim Azzarelli? Because this is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor." And I thought, wow, this is great. But because of Justice O'Connor and other judges around the world, we were able to have a center. We changed the laws in Cambodia. I mean, it had this whole big collective purpose coalition, we like to call it, ended up changing the laws in Cambodia. And, you know, the world is a very different place now. So it's that one person, that one act. The doctor was volunteering for the Virtue Foundation, and their motto was one person at a time, one act at a time. And I really believe that when we find that purpose and we can understand our own power, we can take that act and then collectively work together. I mean, in the book, you'll see my purpose coalition. We call it a purpose coalition, how, you know, each person that we met along the journey that Milan likes to talk about creates this incredible force for good. And we cannot underestimate that. For me, that was one of the most important things coming out of this book, which is the science confirms it. If you find your purpose, it can elevate your life, it can elevate your career, and we can change the world.
Milan, you've devoted your whole life to service, but what were some early moments and some stories, whatever country you visited, of, you know, one individual that resonates with you who really made you realize that we can really change this?
Well, I'm just inspired all the time by the people I meet, because they're ordinary people, yet they have a vision that things don't have to be the way they are, that one can dream about what can be, and they go for it. Often at great personal risk. Some are harmed horribly in the process. And you know, was it Margaret Mead who said that when a group of citizens, committed citizens, come together, you can change the world? It's the only thing that ever has. And so I think there's a hunger for purpose in our world today. Maybe it's the quick-paced life we all lead. Maybe it's the feeling that we really all can make a difference. And one of the things that always inspires me is people like us. I saw this in my years in the White House, where we were working on a program called Vital Voices. And it was really to help women from the former Soviet Union at the time, who were now hopefully moving into nascent democracies, market economies where they never were. They were well-educated. And the question was, is this going to go forward without half the people in those countries playing a role? And what was so encouraging was how many women and men, people like us, with communication skills, advocacy skills, business skills, said, I want to be a part of that. I want to volunteer. I want to help raise those voices up so they can be the change makers in their society. And some years later, the summit that Fortune magazine has for people like that are called the all-powerful women, Andrea Jung was the CEO of Avon. She was prominent there. But today, it is literally so many women, even in that organization, who came together much later through the State Department and agreed to mentor women from other countries to enable them to learn the skill set they wanted and needed to be successful, mostly in business. And I made a policy of trying to meet with some of these women years later when I would travel and to see, did it have any impact on them? And almost always, maybe always, not almost always, they were much more significant in their business. It was growing. They expanded their markets, etc. But to a person, they went home and they determined to play that experience, to pay that experience forward and create mentoring programs in Kenya, to create comparable programs in India. They took what was done for them and created so much more for others. But the mentors, these powerful women, said that this was among the greatest personal experiences they had, perhaps the most meaningful. And the head of this summit in the book says, it's probably the most significant thing any of us has done, with tremendous personal rewards for each of us. I came out to Silicon Valley as an ambassador. And the first thing the women said to me, Sheryl Sandberg on down, was what can we do? Today there are programs called Tech Women, Tech Girls, that are changing the lives of women and girls the world over because people here in the Valley are investing in them, giving them the wherewithal to be able to progress so that they can be leaders in their own societies. So it's these forces of change, and in every instance, it's brought meaning to the lives of the people who've been involved in bigger ways, perhaps, than even their professional success.
And as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I thought when I started working on that project in Cambodia that I was doing something. And if I really think about it, that child changed my life. She probably did a lot more. She can now see. She's 10 years old. She's going to school. It's great. But I honestly believe that that changed my life. And so, you know, we think that we're doing something for other people, and I think you just said it very well, but actually it's us that's really being transformed. And so, you know, Barry Schwartz, who wrote the recent book, Why We Work, talks about, you know, sort of this curse of social comparison. We're always comparing ourselves up, right? We're never really understanding the way the world really is. We only see the person who makes a couple dollars more than us, and we're always feeling that we didn't do enough or we're not successful enough. And I think the media reinforces that a lot. You know, we have these sort of definitions of success, our media friends that we compare ourselves to. And it used to be that we used to live in sort of these environments where we, you know, compare ourselves to our neighbors. But now, you know, you're comparing yourself to Brangelina or whomever, you name your celebrity. And so people are always feeling that they're not measuring up. And I think a part of the thing that happens when you work in these different ways, whether it's here or anywhere else, when you get out of yourself, you start to see your life through a broader lens. And you start to recognize, wow, we really do have so much to be grateful for. And it just changes your perspective. And I think that's one of the most important things. Milan often talks about mutual self-interest and how we need to make the case for why women drive economies. And the same thing is mutual self-interest in this scenario too. Ultimately, we're self-interested human beings, that's what we are. But if your self-interest can help other people and you benefit so much from it, you start to realize you become addicted to it. And I think that's kind of the world we all want to live in.
Well, we could go on here forever, I think, but I know in about 5 minutes we're going to take some questions from the audience for Milan and Kim. But let me, and when we do that, there's a microphone right over there. So you'll just kind of, if you can line up over there, we'll take questions in a few minutes. But let me just ask a couple more here. In the book, there's discussion about how women deal with no and how women deal with failure. So my questions are to both of you, do women deal with that differently? Do women take rejection differently? Do women deal with failure differently? You know, why do we talk about that when we're probably not talking about that with men? Why is that a subject matter that constantly keeps coming up?
Well, first of all, in the book, there's a toolkit at the end. So it lays out the case. There's data. There are inspirational stories from some 70 people at all levels whom we interviewed, some very famous, some whose names you never heard about, older, more senior, as well as a lot of millennials who are in their own way making huge change, very positive change. And one of the things in the section on Know Your Power that's very difficult, it's certainly difficult for women, it's hard for anybody, but it's particularly difficult for women to adjust to a failure, to a no. I don't know if we're always driven to get those A's or we just don't want to take the risk because we're afraid the door will be shut in our face or somehow we won't succeed. We certainly have a confidence gap that's well documented, that we suffer from the anxiety of not really believing in ourselves. And we have advice from a number of people who've had to confront this. One was a young woman. She was determined to go to Yale. She was turned down once. She went back to say, no, you shouldn't have turned me down. She was turned down again. She was turned down the third time, and then finally, I don't know if it was their exasperation of hers or something that made her finally be able to go. But she talked about what it was to keep failing, and what she was learning about herself in the process. She, in fact, said, "You know, I think we should have failure parties because it would help us overcome some of this. And in some ways, I don't particularly espouse failure parties, but whatever helps to make a difference could move in that direction. Today, she has founded an organization called Girls Who Code. In the next couple years, 1 million girls around the world will be coding. Very big issue in technology today. I don't need to tell anybody. Here in this room, which is probably much closer to the industry than anywhere else in the United States, that we don't have anywhere near the number of girls we should have in this field. Something happens, whether it's their confidence, whether it's not being inspired. But when you look at university life today, the great majority of students, are female, in graduate school as well. 20% of women are in the tech field, in STEM, in science, math, engineering, et cetera. And so what she has seen
is
her
that,
purpose.
You think?
I think some of it is media and how the interpersonal relations. Some of it is not getting encouragement in the classroom. Nowhere that I'm aware of is computer science, for example, an academic course. It's sort of an extracurricular. There are organizations now that have been set up to really model women who've made it in the field, as well as to support and inspire girls to move in that direction. But the point is there's much to be done, and there are people doing it. Mm-hmm. And if we all found our purpose wherever we sit, and are inspired by whatever drives us, the passion we have, the change we want to make, the difference we want to make, we really can hasten the day when we will collectively be at a better place.
Yeah, I think that this word no question that you ask is really important, because I think one of the problems that we have is that if we don't get comfortable hearing the word no, we can't ask for things. And I got a great piece of advice when I was very young that you have to get comfortable being uncomfortable. You know, people are very critical of women leaders or women who speak out about things or have opinions. That's sort of an issue that we have in the media, where we sort of set women up to have to be at there's a double standard clearly, but we have to really have a certain very careful model of what success looks like. And I think it's very difficult that we have to be in that sort of perfection mindset, and then you hear no. And so if you can't hear no, you can't ask for things. So I think it holds us back a lot. And I do think we should throw failure parties, because I think
she's
always
young, I'm not.
We're always celebrating success. And, you know, I think we have to celebrate failure, because we all know in this environment that, you know, what is it? Minimum viable product, right? The quicker you can get to market, you learn, you test. So if you can't hear rejection, if you can't be criticized, if you take in everything so heavily, it's very hard to move forward. And I think the media has a lot to do with that. I just want to say that Gina Davis's work on the role of media and the way the media portrays women is really amazing. But what's interesting is that 17% that we were talking about, that leadership gap at the top, you know, Gina found, for example, that in crowd scenes, there's only 17% women. 50% of the population, 17% women. So we start to see 17% maybe as normal, you know, or the fact that when girls watch more TV, they lose confidence. When boys watch more TV, they gain confidence. So there's something going on in our culture that is encouraging certain types of behavior among women and, holding us back in ways that we all have to. So I think for all of us, it's really important to think about what we're taking in, what we are accepting as our model of success and our standard. And I think, again, we're at this place where we could really challenge that definition of success.
I met an Arab woman once, and she was bemoaning the fact that there's no family values in the United States. I said, I don't know how you can say that, because we do treasure our families. We are family-oriented. And she said, oh, no. We watch your television programs. We know what you're really like. On the other hand, it models interest and behavior that can be very positive. For example, large numbers of young women today are going into forensics because they got hooked on the CIS programming. So, you know, there are forces and counterforces, but the media is a very dominant force in
Gina
society.
Gina calls that the CSI effect, right? Watching too much CSI you might want to become a forensic scientist.
Before we go to audience Q&A, just can you elaborate a little bit more, Kim, on the toolkit? Because I think that is one of the really unique aspects of this book. I mean, everybody understands that we've got to make significant progress really quickly and break through it, that this is an inflection point. But the pragmatic approach and pragmatic advice, can you just talk a little bit about the toolkit and what...
I mean, the toolkits are really really the benefit of all the interviews that we've done. It's the benefit of a lot of research and experiences that we've had over the years. But the toolkit is really about the practical guide to finding your own power, you know, understanding your skills, your unique talents, your resources. We all have them, you know, and again, sometimes we may feel we don't have power. Sometimes we wake up and we feel there's no way we could do it. We're never going to be what, you know, these models of success, but it's just untrue. And so the first part is about understanding your own power, understanding where you sit, and it doesn't have to be at the CEO level. That's a really important part of this book. The second thing is finding your purpose. We gave a whole roadmap on how to find your purpose, which is interesting. I mean, each person's purpose is very different, and even how you define purpose, as you said, is very different. But it's important to take the time to reflect on these things, because we are in this world where we don't even reflect anymore. We just sort of go about what we do. But the third part, and this is why Milan and I started Seneca Women, is connecting with other people. Because when you find like-minded people who share your values, it gives you the energy. And ultimately, you have to have the energy, because life is hard, right? You don't get up every day and it's like, every day is not a great day. You know, you don't wake up, some days you wake up, you feel awful. Some things are, life is hard. Things happen to everybody. Nobody escapes the human condition. So if you find other people, though, who share your values, it gives you the energy to keep going and to fight for the things that you care about and to just shape your world the way you want to shape it. So we've started Seneca Women for that reason, which is to connect women and men, but obviously we're focused really on advancing women and girls, so men who are interested in these issues, to connect each other. We kind of jokingly call it the new golf, but women don't necessarily want to hang out on the golf course, right? They, you know, want to network with each other, but also create some positive impact. And so we've created Seneca Women to showcase organizations around the world who are making a huge difference, but also to connect women so that you guys, it's, you know, and us, we can all collaborate together, find our own purpose coalitions, and really unleash the change that we know we can see. We cannot wait any longer.
And collect the stories of so many and what changed your life. What are you doing? What will inspire others? Mm-hmm. And there are so many organizations in this country and around the world that desperately need accountants and lawyers, not for you to leave your positions, but to just really have impact on them in ways that can be transformative. So that's what we want to do to help activate what we're saying in the book. This really needs to be a part of all of us.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I had the opportunity to mentor and know Kim when she was a very young lawyer, and I'll never forget a story that you told me about why you left the law firm. And so I don't even know if you remember our conversation way back then, but it did stick with me because it really was about value system and feeling connected. So maybe you wanted to share it with.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to, which I generally don't like to talk about, but you know, I was working at the law firm, great practice. I loved my job. I was working really hard, of course, like everybody else. But I liked, you know, I was kind of one of those geeky people who wanted a suit when they were seven. It's true. I got one, by the way. And, you know, so I really liked business and I liked what I was doing. But my clients, you know, there was one client in particular who had a different idea for how we could go celebrate something that a deal that we had just done. And so I ended up in a very unfortunate place, which was not my idea of a good time, a kind of club that I'm not really used to frequenting. And so the next morning I woke up and I called two people. One was my mother, and the second one was my feminist jurisprudence professor. And I said, something's gone terribly wrong in my life. I went to law school because I wanted to make a difference for women and girls. I have loans to pay. I went to get a job at one of the law firms. But I like corporate. But, you know, now I like got dragged to this club and I'm going to quit my job. And she said, well, listen, you know, we have a lot of people knocking on the door from the outside trying to make change, but we don't have many people on the inside. And you seem to have a talent for corporate. So why don't you keep going and see what happens? And I think the point that she made that day was so instructive and so insightful that really it's an inside job in the sense that we need women in positions all over, corporate America for sure, corporations all over the world, government, everywhere. We need women. And so if we're constantly wanting to get away from these difficult situations, which was the case for me, she really inspired me to realize I can make more change by keep doing what I'm doing and doing it well. And, you know, lo and behold, a couple years later, I heard that there was a job at Avon, the company for women, right? So I thought, wow, that's the job for me. And then I knew that there was a young CEO, the youngest female CEO of a Fortune 500 company at the time. Andrea Jung, and I thought, well, let me go put my hat in the ring, and the rest of my life sort of changed because of that. But I have to say that that concept of being it's an inside job is so important. We have to stick with it because we can make a difference from within and from without. And I think Milan alluded to the fact that we have unprecedented skills. I mean, what we're doing with Seneca Women is really the idea that we can all use our skills. It's not about just being a lawyer or being a doctor or being a surgeon. Everybody has something to offer, and everybody, if we do offer it, we can make the big difference that we want to see. So I really think that, I think that's what you're alluding to. I'm not sure, but.
It is, exactly.
Could I just say, because you probably are asking yourselves, why Seneca Women? Mm-hmm. And it really goes back to the first Equal Rights Convention in the United States, which took place over 150 years ago, Seneca Falls, New York. And I remember vividly reading the memoirs of one of the young women who was going to the convention. And she had great doubts, confidence gap. She worried that nobody would be on the road going there. And she wrote in her diary that she felt she really had to go because here she was a glove maker. She was all of 17 or 18 years old. The wages she earned, she couldn't keep. You couldn't get a divorce if you were in a horrible marriage. You couldn't vote. You had very few prospects if you were a woman. And she went, and she said, as the sun came up, she began to see at the crossroads lots of stagecoaches, lots of people on foot, men and women. Mm. And in the end, when that declaration was signed of progress for women in the United States, hope for progress, a third of the signers were men, led by Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, who said he was ennobled. He had worked to end slavery, and he felt even more ennobled because now he wasn't working for his own people. He was trying to move gender equality 150 years ago in the United States. So that's why Seneca. We're at another historic moment. Mm. We have lots more factors that enable us to make progress, and we need to really tap those today.
Seneca 2.0. So it's time for Q&A, I think, from the audience. So again, the microphone is over there, and you can just keep your questions brief so we can have as many questions as possible. Kim and Milan will answer them.
Okay, thank you. You're speaking to my purpose and passion in life. The director of Peace Corps is a woman right now. I hope you know her because you could utilize the 7,000 or 8,000 volunteers that are in developing nations now, working some in small enterprise development and health and stuff. Could you please speak to what you are doing to work with groups like Peace Corps and other groups that are in country to further the development of women?
Well, Carrie Radelet is really a good friend of mine. Her husband is a colleague. He used to be at USAID. He's at Georgetown now doing development. She's an extraordinary person, and Peace Corps today is continuing to be lots of young people who want to go and serve their country and make a difference. It's also people of middle age and closer to retirement age who want to go in and spend that next chapter in a way that will have impact. She is constantly looking for partners in that process, but it's also interesting that this is a program that has had strong support from both sides of the political aisle in our Congress, and yet it's stuck at a certain percentage of resources. It really needs more resources to allow so many Americans who want to be a part of it to be able to participate. And I think if there's anything we can do, and we're moved by it, it's both to form partnerships through other organizations. For example, they've partnered on Let Girls Learn, where more and more Peace Corps volunteers are focusing on girls' education separately from their own projects or in addition to their own projects. But it also needs public resources, and I think any advocacy we can do for that purpose is critically important. So thank you for raising it.
So Seneca Women, to answer the second part of your question, SenecaWomen.com is a platform to showcase these different organizations around the world because there's so many incredibly unrecognized, under-resourced organizations. And so if we can use our power, quote-unquote, for purpose, part of our purpose is lifting up those organizations, making them visible to the rest of the world, because, you know, we really believe that it's through those channels of organizations that we can make incredible change.
Thank you. Next.
Hi, thanks for coming tonight. Really appreciate having this kind of discourse in the room. thinking first domestically at how difficult a time we've had closing the gap between the genders, how do we also close the gap between white women and Latinas, African-American women, indigenous peoples? What are some things we can do? You mentioned in India quotas. We've had affirmative action. Where can we go from here?
You know, it's a really important question because, as we show in the book, so many of the challenges that we confront, the unfinished business, really is affecting people of color, women of color in greater numbers, and we have a long road to go. And I think, first and foremost, it's a recognition of the unfairness. Many of these are people who do the hardest jobs in our society that we all count on every day to make our lives more comfortable. And, you know, we had Maria Shriver with us yesterday in Los Angeles, and she has done so much work with the Shriver Report focusing on the problems of women in peril. And many, many are women who are at this perilous point, one paycheck away from utter disaster, because we're not responding in the ways that we need to. Simple idea that she pointed out, for example, are the housekeepers in hotels. Certainly their wages make a difference, but so do any ways that we can be cognizant of the services they render and leaving them the kind of gratuities that can enhance their wages, which obviously I'm not for enhancing wages just through tips, but clearly to be paid that fair wage and do this in addition because they make such a difference with back-breaking work. But there's so much needs to be done. And you know, there are a lot of organizations focused on these populations that are probably the most under-resourced. And it is those that we want to bring to the attention of so many others who may not realize it.
You know, I also want to add to that question that, you know, when I think about the women in my life who have been mentors, I think it's really important that we have models, role models. You know, it's Madeleine Albright who has that great quote about saying that, you know, she never thought she could be Secretary of State because she never saw a Secretary of State with a dress or a skirt on. But now we have these incredible role models, and women of color are the agents of change right now. And I think about two women role models for me, Judge Ann Claire Williams of the Seventh Circuit, the first African-American woman on the Seventh Circuit, and Sharon Bowen, one of the first African-American women lawyers, now one of the first African-American women commissioner of the CFTC. And so these women are a force of nature, and they are modeling success in ways that is unbelievable to me. I mean, both of those, just those two women alone could change the world, in my opinion. So I feel that women of color, yes, there's huge problems happening, obviously, all over the country and all over the world. But we also are at this moment again. I feel that this is an optimistic moment because we see role models. There are women in positions of power with experience and with perspectives that have never been brought at that level before. And so we're at an inflection point.
First of all, congratulations on your work and your important message. It's very impressive. I'd be anxious to hear more about what specific actions you think we should be taking. So first of all, at a national level, what are the things in terms of policy, if you're advising the president, what two or three things do you think should be done at a national level? What things should be done at a corporate level? If you were to talk to CEOs, here's two or three things you need to do. And if you're at an individual level, what are those two or three things that need to be done?
Since we only have a few minutes, maybe we can each pick one quick thing for each of those, and that we'll get a couple. I would say at the policy level, my advice to the president would be paid childcare, period, end of story. Maternity leave, paid maternity leave, paid paternity leave, childcare. We need a child, we need a national childcare system, and we need paid leave. So that's one on, and I'll be quick, so that's one on the policy level. On the corporate level, it is what we do right now, which is we tell CEOs that you need to think about women as strategic partners, not as philanthropic gestures, but if you want to be competitive and you think about India and you think about China in that way, you better be thinking about women that way because women are the fastest growing economic force in the world today. So it's in your self-interest, CEO, to think about women as a strategic partner. So have a women's strategy.
And I would concur on both. Obviously, we have these critical social issues in this country that really need to be addressed. On the corporate level, the companies that get it are doing really extraordinary things today, using their sourcing, their supply chain, to buy from women entrepreneurs in excess of billions of dollars. And that way, that growing market, if you're a small business person and you can meet that scale demand, imagine how your business grows. Providing training and mentoring for women both in this country and around the world who are strategic to emerging markets and recognizing just how strategic they are. So the business world has every reason, if it only looks at its own success, its bottom line, I don't have a problem with that. Business is in the business of making profits.
Can I add something, Milan? I would say women on boards, and that is as equally to a founding, a founder, a startup here, as it is a Fortune 200 company. I'll just use one large example, but the auto industry, has gone for years and years and years with just lack of representation or not enough representation. And if you look at the consumer dynamics, 80% of passenger car decisions are made by women. The color of the minivan, the color of the car. Women are making the decisions of a family car, not just here, in China, in Brazil, all around the world, but the representation, not just in management, but on the governing boards, it doesn't reflect who they are not only selling to today, but who's going to be the future of that enterprise. So my advice to a founder, a startup, or a large company would be, make sure that there's that opportunity to have that representation as well.
And there's not much progress in that space. And we've got a lot of data today that correlates women's participation at that level to the profitability of companies and to the vitality of the product lines and the design and everything that goes with that bottom line. For the individual, I would say, look at yourself. What are you passionate about? Where do you want to see change? Who can you come together with? Hopefully our opportunities through Seneca Women can help, but you may not even feel you need the help. But really go for it, because you are incredibly needed, and this is a moment where those opportunities can make all the difference in a way they never have.
One more question, last one.
Going back to the idea of role models, who was your first female role model when you were growing up, and how did they inspire you?
Well, my first historic female role model, you want to go ahead, Lynn?
Well, I didn't have a female role model that I really thought about, but who inspired me was a young president, and I think it's fine to have male champions as well, who said, don't ask what you can do for your country, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That inspired a whole generation of us. And another one that he said at the time was, some people see things as they are and ask why. We shrug our shoulders, we say, woe is us. Other people dream of what could be. And I think to be that visioner, that dreamer, that person who understands we can make a difference, that's what inspired me, besides my own family. But they were bigger than life as I was growing up. And I know you're a high school student, and I'm really pleased that you're here tonight.
For me, when growing up, I had this real connection to Susan B. Anthony. I cannot explain it. I think it must be a past life thing. But for me, I got that silver dollar from my grandmother, who was also my role model, with Susan B. Anthony on it. And for me, the thought that these women, starting at Seneca Falls, as I said before, worked 70 years to get us the right to vote. Susan B. Anthony traveled every week for 50 years, and not by Uber or Lyft, to actually advocate for women's rights and to get women the right to vote. We didn't have the right to vote. We didn't have the right to own property in most states. We didn't have the right to a divorce. So these, to me, are the women that we stand on the shoulders of. I think there are women today, though, like that. And I always mention this other woman from a totally different environment who is in the book as well. Her name was Malek Jan. She was blind, frail, in rural Iran. And she, through her purpose-driven life, the courage that she had, she was able to change the mindsets
of men and women, which we have to think about, men and women, on the role and value of girls in her village. And it had this ripple effect that went way, way beyond her village. And I think we have to remember that people can make change in quiet, courageous ways all over the world. So we know there are very famous people that we know, and of course Susan B. Anthony is one of them, but there are also women all over the world, and Milan's met so many of them who are making change right now as we sit here.
Thank you. All right, before we close, it is an informed tradition to ask our speakers this following question. So I'll start with you, Milan. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? Go.
Fast forward women and girls around the world. Advance them, and we will realize huge dividends.
Kim, your 60-second idea to change the world.
So my 60-second idea is, after 25 years of thinking about it, is Seneca Women. And the idea is to connect women all over the world to each other, to the data to make the case, to inspiring organizations, because we do believe it's that connectivity that can fast forward us.
Thank you. Okay, well, let's give a big round of applause.
Thank you to all of you.
Thank you.